This is the family way lecture on Rodogun, taking place in week 5. I just want to talk to you initially about the materials you'll need alongside you when you listen to this lecture. There is a handout which you can click on and download, which takes you through the secondary criticism that I refer to in the lecture, and then cross references to other pieces of information that I'll allude to in the course of the lecture, and I'll underline what those features will be as I go along. There is also a PowerPoint presentation, a short PowerPoint presentation to accompany the lecture, which you can have open, and I'll endeavour to point out to you the relevant slides as we go along in the course of the lecture as well. Okay, so let me begin then by talking to you a little bit about the history to this play. It was written in 1644, probably, but not published until 1647. Rodogun is often viewed as a transitional play, marking a return to tragedy for Corneille after the composition of two comedies, Le Menteur, published in 1643, and La Suite du Menteur, published in 1644-45. So, a number of what have been regarded as Corneille's most successful tragedies were in fact composed before Rodogun, and they're listed on your handout together with the relevant dates. So we have Lucide, published in 1637, Horace, published in 1640, Cinna, published in 1642, and Polyeucte, published in 1643. So these tragedies have long been viewed as constituting Corneille's high period of tragic writing, but this view has also been challenged by some. It's very clear, for instance, that Rodogun was a very popular play in its time, and Corneille confesses that he has a particular fondness for it, as we shall see. Just a quick word about the different editions of this play and about the edition that we're using. You'll see that in 1660, Corneille produces a major 3-volume republication of his plays with revisions and with accompanying discours and examen, in which he looks at the structure of his play, looks at characterisation, looks at a number of things. Okay. So in the 1647 edition of the play, there is an avertissement that prefaces the play, and which I'll make reference to in just a moment. In the 1660 re-edition of the play, that avertissement is replaced by the examen to the play, which I'll also make reference to. And I just want to stress that I'm using the 2004 Gallimard edition of this play, edited by Jean Suroy. So page references that you'll hear and that you'll see on the handout are to that edition of the play. Okay, then, let's begin by talking about the plot of the play. And it's not a particularly straightforward plot, so you'll have to listen carefully. What I want to do first is to take you through the background to the play, the historical background to the play. And what I'm doing here is essentially covering the ground that Corneille himself covers in his avertissement and in the examen. He tells us there, then, that the principal protagonist of the play, Cléopâtre, is queen of Syria. Her first husband, Demetrius Nicanor, known as Nicanor in the play, undertook various military exploits which took him to Part, or Parthia, where he was taken captive for a period of some years, and Cléopâtre, in fact, did not know whether he was alive or dead. The Parthians remained a threat to Cléopâtre, so she sent her two sons by her first marriage, Seleucus and Antiochus, into exile in Egypt to be cared for by her own brother, King Ptolemy. So those two children, Seleucus and Antiochus, are the children of Cléopâtre and Nicanor. Subsequently, Cléopâtre married another Antiochus, Nicanor's brother, when she finally believed Nicanor to be dead. After 7 years on the throne, Antiochus himself embarked on a campaign against the Parthian enemy, during which he was killed. Nicanor, it subsequently emerged, was not dead, and in fact had married Rodogune, sister of the Parthian king, whilst in Parthia. He then returned with Rodogune to Syria in order to conquer it, and was ambushed and murdered, reputedly by Cleopatra herself, who acted out of jealousy and fear of loss of political control. Seleucus and Antiochus then become heirs to the Syrian throne, and as this play opens, they've returned from Egypt to take on the mantle of kingship. So what Corneille tells us in the avertissement to the play, and subsequently in the Examen, is that these facts are, broadly speaking, historically founded, being based on the account of Appian, which he quotes, and also on some other, based on the accounts of other ancient sources, which he makes reference to. And if you look at slide 6, you'll see these set out for you. There are some differences, and I'll highlight these in a moment. I just, secondly, then want to look at the play itself and what happens in the body of the play. As Corneille also tells us, this historical material provides the background to the play and most of the food for the first act. And Leonis, who is a minor character in the play, Cleopatra's confidant, fills in the audience on this historical backdrop in the course of Act 1. What follows after Act 1 then is a drama that is largely the result of invention by Corneille, and which he very readily stresses is the result of his own imagination, and he does that both in the avertissement and in the examen. So I just want to take you through then the plot of the play itself and those elements of the plot which Corneille makes clear he has invented. Firstly then, Corneille depicts the sons, Seleucus and Antiochus, as twins in this play, and he gives Cleopatra the power of naming the twin who is the firstborn and will win the throne. So in fact, the dramatic nœud of the play, the dramatic tension, centres around the need for one of these two sons to accede to the throne. So there is a need, the country is in need of a king because Cleopatra has murdered their father. And the central tension in the play then is the question of who is the firstborn, who will she name? Secondly, Rodogune, in the course of the play, is now held captive in Syria, but she is not a widow in Corneille's version. Corneille modifies the historical data to suggest that Nicanor did not in fact marry her in Parthia, but brought him with her to Syria with the intention of marrying her there in order to win for her acceptance by the Syrian people. So in Corneille's version of events then, Nicanor is killed before he and Rodogune have had the occasion to marry. And this is done also for reasons of bienséance, and that's set out for us in the avertissement on page 43 and in the examen on page 52 of your text. Cleopatra then has made a new treaty with Parthia in which Rodogune will still become queen but will now marry whichever of her sons accedes to the throne, so whichever of her sons she names. Corneille also tells us in the avertissement and in the examen that in his play, Cleopatra's marriage to Antiochus was not prompted by jealousy at Nicanor's own marriage, as was the case in the ancient accounts, but by necessity. And we'll see that in the examen, pages 51 to 52. Also in Act 1, we're told that the Syrian people, believing Nicanor to be dead, insisted that Cleopatra remarry. So Cleopatra's central reason for murdering her husband in the play then is anger that she and her sons would lose power by his attempts to reconquer Syria in a new alliance with a new wife. Finally, there are some further twists or nœuds in Corneille's plot which add further to the dramatic tension. Both the brothers are in love with Rodogune. She only loves one of them in return, and in the early part of the play, the identity of the son she loves remains a mystery. Another twist is that Cleopatra does not intend to adhere to the terms of the treaty with Parthia, and she in fact requires her sons to kill Rodogune in the name of family honour. So Corneille then is using a historical plot that would not have been terribly well known as the starting point of a largely fictional drama that revolves around the tensions provoked by questions of primogeniture, that is, who is the firstborn? And the tensions around those questions are linked also with conflicts of maternal instinct and duty, conflicting them with unnatural female desires to maintain power, on the one hand, and we also see a conflict between filial political duty, the duty that the sons feel towards their mother, and their own passionate sexual love for Ardoghun. Okay, so if you've managed to take on all of that, I now want you to further into the play then, into an analysis of the play, and to think about the effectiveness of this play as a piece of drama. Now, to some extent at least, Ardoghun echoes certain features of Cornelian drama exhibited in earlier plays. And what I want to do first of all then is just take you through the kind of typical features of Cornelian tragedy as exhibited in those four plays that I have listed for you on the handout. Corneille was renowned for his strong characters, his heroic characters. These were characters drawn from aristocracy as required according to the rules of tragedy set out in Aristotle's Poetics. And of course, Aristotle's Poetics was a revered document in the 17th century as rules for 17th century tragic drama began to be set out in the course of the century. So Corneille's heroes then were often extremely single-minded in pursuit of goals they believed to be worthy. His heroes were often seen to be in conflict with political power structures, but they wished to act for the long-term good of the state and were prepared to sacrifice themselves in this cause. Self-discipline and a recourse to reason were essential for the Cornelian hero. He or she would not permit passions to detract him or her from the mission and belief that they had set for themselves, however tempting those passions may have been. Cornelian heroes were also concerned with the acquisition of gloire, with building for themselves a wider reputation in the context of public obligations and duties, building for themselves then a great name, great renown. They also exhibit what was known as générosité, a kind of selfless courage. So those features then, which are typical of Corneille's high period tragedies, some of those we'll see featuring in this play as well. But this play can also be viewed as a new departure for Corneille for two principal reasons. First of all, the drama of this play emerges much more firmly from its plot. This concern with plot that Corneille exhibits in this play is new, and it's clearly particularly exciting for Corneille because he invented the plot. The effectiveness of the plot relies upon a complex interplay between knowledge and power. Corneille reveals what we want to know only very slowly. So we wonder, will Cleopatra ever reveal which of the twins is the eldest? And will we believe her when she does? Who does Ardoghun really love, we wonder, in the early stages of the play? Will love ever really win the day over duty and political obligation? And will the bond of brotherly love between Seleucus and Antiochus break down? In fact, we never find out from Corneille which of the twins is the elder, although in history, Seleucus was the elder brother. Secondly, we have to acknowledge that in this play, the principal protagonist, Cleopatra, is a monster. So knowing that, we might wonder where the Cornelian hero and Cornelian ideals associated with heroism have gone to. Cleopatra is aggressive in her pursuit of power. She never exhibits self-sacrifice. And it's interesting then to raise the question of whether the change of mood that can be associated, that can be seen in this play, might be associated with the period of regency that we've moved into. And you can see that movement set out for you under key historical events on your handout. Certainly, selflessness in this play is replaced by self-interest, and reason frequently gives way to passion. There is a feeling of instability that may in some degree pick up on the political and social instability that was felt under the rule of Anne of Austria with Cardinal Mazarin at the helm. And we'll think about these questions both in seminars and later on in the lecture. So we need now to pin down what this play might be about. Is it a play about love? And if so, what kind of love? Now, a point often made by critics of 17th century tragic drama is that Racine's tragedies are essentially about the struggle of the individual to manage internal passions. So love, then, is his subject. And you'll have seen that in your study of Phèdre. Corneille, meanwhile, was held to be more interested in external constraints through which acts of heroism might shine. In fact, the reason for this difference in thematic approach are partly social and cultural, because of Racine writing firmly in the second half of the 17th century, a good deal later than Corneille. And we'll in fact look at these differences as we compare Rodogun with Atalée in a couple of weeks' time. But now I think it is interesting to look at the way in which Corneille explores a favourite theme for him, which is the tension between love and duty. And it's clear that there is a struggle in this play between different kinds of love. And the first kind of love that I want to think about is maternal love. In his notes to the Droz edition of the play, Jacques Scherrer says this about Cléopâtre. Elle est à peu près dénuée de sentiments maternels. And you see that under the section A Play About Love on page 2 of your handout. We might want to take issue with this statement, of course, but it certainly makes clear that on the face of it, Cléopâtre lacks entirely maternal instinct. So how is this lack seen in the play? There's an interesting build-up of tension around this mother figure. She doesn't, in fact, make an appearance until Act 2, but she's the source of rumour in Act 1. Will she act with maternal clemency towards Rodogun, who must become her new daughter-in-law according to the terms of the treaty contracted with Parthia? See Act 1, Scene 5. When she finally does appear, she is the immediate incarnation of hatred and deceit. She will not accept Rodogun. She makes it clear that she loathes her. And moreover, and perhaps more importantly, she loathes the power that Rodogun might soon possess in Cleopatra's place by becoming queen. So, feeling as she does about her future daughter-in-law, Cleopatra soon reveals that she's apt to play games, and to play games particularly with maternal privilege. She wants to keep her sons guessing as to who is the elder, so that neither of them can attain power and that she can keep it for herself. Now, in order to keep that power, she requires the sympathy and devotion of her sons. So she's prepared to live out two narratives. And in one narrative, the narrative that she gives to her sons when she sees them, when she's on stage with them, She presents herself as an attentive mother whose past actions have been undertaken entirely to protect those sons. So to Seleucus and Antiochus, she tells a story of mother love in Act 2, Scene 3. However, we also see another side to her on stage. She presents herself also in Act 2, Scene 2, for instance, as an independent ruler who has had to act at all times to secure her own position. She rather mistakenly hopes and trusts that her sons will be made in her own image. We see this attacked at 2, scenes 3 and 4. She believes that they will be similarly motivated by the quest for power. And thus, when she requires that they carry out an act of revenge on her behalf to kill Rodogune, she assumes that they will embrace this act of revenge readily. In fact, her sons are horrified at this request made by their mother. They recognise at this moment that their mother is a monster, and the idea that they should somehow be related to her and should somehow resemble her or mirror her haunts them throughout the play from that point on. Cleopatra then fundamentally fails to understand that her son's behaviour and her son's horror at her request might be the result of other forms of love and not love for power. She finds this lack of love for power so abhorrent, in fact, that finally she wants to destroy them along with Rodogune. The lack of maternal instinct that she exhibits in this respect seems very unnatural to us, but in Cleopatra's eyes, it's her sons who are the unnatural ones, and you particularly see this set out in her encounter with Antiochus in Act 4, Scene 3. It's worth just reflecting on the abhorrent request that Cleopatra makes to her sons, that they should kill Rodogune. She paints this as being the price that they ought to pay for her motherly devotion. Thus then, at that point, the two separate narratives that we've seen her exhibit in Act 2, Scene 2, and Act 2, Scene 3, so the maternal side of her on the one hand and the political side of her on the other, come together. Cleopatra then sees self-preservation as inextricably linked to the preservation of the throne. There is another love, however, which intersects this warped maternal love that we see Cleopatra setting out for her son. And that is romantic sexual love, love of the twins for Rodogune. We know, as I say, that Rodogune is in love with one of the two sons. And in the early stages of the play, Act 1, Scene 5, she refuses to announce which son she's in love with. And this is because she's aware that via the treaty contracted with Parthia, it is her duty to marry the rightful heir to the throne. It becomes clear fairly early on in the play, both sons love Rodogune, and that they're willing to admit this to each other, Act 1, Scene 3. Now, having admitted to each other that they both love Rodogune, and that only one of them will, of course, have the opportunity to marry her, they agree that in order to preserve their own filial relationship, she's very strong, they will defer to the pronouncement of their mother, and they will accept that the eldest son should win her hand. So in fact, what we see here is that there is a kind of single-mindedness. There is an idea of duty associated with the throne. The twins are respecting the tradition of primogeniture that insists that the eldest son will reign and that the youngest will in fact come away with very little or nothing. The youngest must, in this system, defer to the power of the eldest. And duty allows both sons to recognise that fact. What complicates things, then, is that Corneille arguably begins to bring this established tradition into question because it's shown to be an ineffective way of assuring political order. And that's because Cleopatra abuses it. She uses the idea of primogeniture as a bargaining tool rather than regarding it as a sacred feature of society, as a means of achieving continuity from generation to generation. So the sons then are brought to the realisation that their mother is less interested in the sacred succession of kingship than she is interested in revenge and in acquiring power by proxy. So she wants her sons to resemble her. She wants them to carry out an act of revenge that is in the spirit of her own killing of their father. And she wants subsequently to reign through them. Once they've seen this, the twins then abandon also the ideal of primogeniture. They reject the power of their mother to name the future king, and they go directly to Radegund themselves. So they replace the ideal of primogeniture with that of free choice based around love. They go to Radegund, who is to be queen, and ask her to choose her husband. She must choose between them, choose which of them should reign alongside her. And that's in Act 3, Scene 4. Radegund, however, is aware that this new offer represents dangers to her, and dangers indeed to the throne and to the subsequent rule. She might set brother against brother. She might also be forced by passion, by her love for one of the two brothers, to make the wrong choice. And here we see that Cornelian kind of internal dispute between passion and reason, with passion regarded as a kind of inferior means of making decisions, of knowing oneself and of knowing a situation clearly. Radegund then, in turn, in Act 3, Scene 4, is forced to make an ultimatum of her own. And that ultimatum is that she requires the sons to take revenge for her loss, that is, the death of Nicanor that she suffered since she was engaged to him and was due to marry him. She will marry then whichever of the sons is prepared to kill their own mother. The sons are, if anything, equally horrified, if not more horrified, by this second ultimatum made by a second rather threatening woman. Having given the situation much thought, Antiochus then approaches Radegund with the intention that she kill him in place of his mother. So he willingly puts himself forward as a sacrifice in order to leave his own brother free to reign and marry Radegund. And once he presents himself as a willing sacrificial victim in this way, Radegund is forced to reveal that it is him rather than Seleucus that she loves, and that's in Act 4, Scene 1. She also reveals that her love for him is based on the knowledge that he would never actually agree to enact vengeance on his own mother in the way that she's requested. And she insists that it was her duty to seek vengeance for Nicanor, that her virtue depended on it, but that she was aware that Antiochus' virtue would lie in his resistance to this kind of abhorrent demand. So yet again, in the fourth act, we find these characters caught in an impasse. Who decides who will reign? The only solution, it seems, at this point in the play, is to fall back on Cleopatra, to allow her to decide who will inherit the throne, and to sacrifice their own happiness if necessary, in order to bring stability to the country. So having looked at romantic love then, we need to turn to the third kind of love that's very apparent in this play, and that is brotherly love. And that very powerful brotherly love is apparent from the moment the brothers decide not to allow jealousy to destroy their own relationship, in spite of the fact that they have professed jointly a love for Radegund, and that's in Act 1, Scene 3. So in that scene, they confess, both of them, they reveal each to the other that they have this love of Goddukun, but they're not prepared to allow that to destroy their own filial relationship, their own fraternal relationship, rather. And in fact, their bond is strengthened when Cleopatra sets the ultimatum for them to kill Rodogun, because they are jointly horrified by this demand, and particularly powerfully horrified by the realisation that some natural family connections cannot be relied upon. So they want to make sure that their own relationship can be relied upon, since there is since it's very clear that they cannot trust their mother. So they share distress at being forced to combat a natural instinct to love and respect their mother, as one might expect. Although they deal with the horror of their mother's ultimatum in rather interestingly different ways. Initially, that ultimatum invites a shared response, and as I've said, they decide that they will give up primogeniture in order to ask Rodogun to choose between them as to who will become king. But once Rodogun administers an ultimatum of her own, the brothers show themselves to have rather different personalities, and we'll just unpick some of those differences in personality in the seminars. So having seen two horrific women present them with ultimatums, and a warped picture of motherly love on the one hand, a warped picture of romantic love, apparently, on the other, they respond in rather different ways, as I've seen. Okay, finally then, I want to take you through some readings of the play, ways in which we might interpret it. A feminist school of criticism, some feminist critics then, have taken issue with the interpretation of Cleopatra as an overwhelmingly evil character with completely irrational and inappropriate demands. Or, at least, they've sought to understand why Corneille would want to create such a mother figure. It's worth pointing out that Corneille in no way wants to play down the frightful and horrific nature of this central character that he has created. And you see that indicated under characters and characteristics on the handout, page 2 of the handout. And this is just a quotation from the first discours in Corneille's writings on the theatre, in which he reflects on the character that he's created. And he says this of her: Cléopâtre dans Rodogune est très méchante. Il n'y a point de parricide qui lui fasse horreur, pourvu qu'il la puisse conserver sur un trône qu'elle préfère à toute chose, tant son attachement à la domination est violent. Mais tous ses crimes sont accompagnés d'une grande dame qui a quelque chose de si haut qu'en même temps qu'on déteste ses actions, on admire la source dont elle part. So that acknowledgement then of the cruelty of his central character, it is feminist critics that attempt to unpick and understand that in interesting detail. Let's run through some of those approaches now. Anne Menker then, in The Widow Who Would Be Queen, listed on your handout, particularly underlines the timing of this play. 1644 then, beginning of the regency period of Anne of Austria. Menke says that the presence of a female ruler then at this time invites ambivalent responses, particularly in France then, where Salic law prevents a woman from acceding to the throne and therefore from ruling in any other circumstances. So according to Salic law, then, the rule of a woman can only ever be seen as a temporary aberration of the status quo, which would always see a king rather than a queen as head of state. So this sense of a kind of temporary aberration is something that might reverberate then through this play. But in fact, Menker argues, Cleopatra has proved herself a very competent ruler. And it's clear in the play that she's highly frustrated that she can't reign in her own right. Does she, in fact, believe that her sons would be less competent than herself? And is this why she desperately clings on to the reins of power? It's certainly interesting to note that Cleopatra's position in the play is sharply at odds with the twin powers of absolutism and bourgeoisie that were beginning to emerge in this period and that emphasised the importance of the patriarchal state and the family and clearly delineated sexual roles within those structures. So could her inability to maintain the centre ground in the play, despite the fact that she does wield a huge amount of power, could this reflect the inability of women in this period to occupy mainstream political positions of power themselves? And that's a question raised by Mary Jo Muratore in Expire o Femina, Narratives of Female Dissolution, also listed on your handout. See page 54 for that. So one can think from a number of different perspectives about the presentation of Cleopatra and her relationship to power, and one can think of those particularly from a feminist standpoint, and you'll see that in some of the criticism you'll come across. There's also a very interesting historicist line that has been taken on this play, and that's been taken particularly by Richard Goodkin and by Greenberg. Greenberg's work listed on your bibliography. Now, Richard Goodkin makes a very interesting study of primogeniture. Birthmarks, the tragedy of primogeniture in Pierre Corneille, Thomas Corneille and Jean Racine. Okay. And in that work, Goodkin has examined the changing social conditions prevailing at the time the play was written and some of the tensions represented therein. These are the tensions that he raises then. He argues that there is an emerging tension between capitalism and feudalism. The old values of the established aristocracy, known as the noblesse d'épée, were increasingly threatened in the 17th century by the rise of the bourgeoisie. So traditions such as primogeniture, which naturally accepted the privileges of the firstborn, began to come into conflict with other processes of exchange and power acquisition. For instance, the making of money through buying and selling, through trade. So once the inheritance of land ceases to be the sole way of acquiring money and power, the principle upon which primogeniture was built was brought into question, argues Goodkin. Now this play, Rodoguin, was written just after the death of Louis XIII, and he, as we have discussed in previous lectures, suffered repeated threats to his position in the form of coups, in the form of the Fronde civil war and so forth, in spite of the principle of primogeniture being that which obtained at the time. So there's increasingly then an awareness that primogeniture may not be an effective way of ensuring security. And we know that Louis XIV will build a court around himself based more and more upon the achievement of rank and status through merit in order to bolster his own political power. So then, assets acquired through merit and quests based on individual desire increasingly compete with the common ideal of birthright and lineage as a means of establishing power that previously existed. And Corneille's play perhaps can be said to represent these latent tensions. So in the end, should a nobleman rely on the pulls of duty and deference to sacred positions such as kingship, or should he rely on his own internal scale of values? Does the ethic of duty really work? In turn, is gloire an inherited quality, or does it come from freely chosen acts? And certainly we see in this play that there is confusion around this question of merit and choice associated with the twins asking Rodoguin to choose which of them she should marry and her resistance to that, and a kind of chronology, an idea of an established pattern of inheritance. So there is a picture in this play of the possibility that marriage and the throne should be earned, should be acquired through merit. But when that's raised, the result frequently is an impasse. And again, Mary Jo Maratore explores that point in her work. One might also want to ask then if the debate between the ancients and the moderns, the querelle des anciens et des modernes, which comes to the fore later in the 17th century, and we'll see its importance when we look at Perrault and the fairy tales, whether that debate is beginning to emerge here. It's clear that we know that Corneille is often at odds with the theatrical establishment and theatre critics in his period. The rules that were set down increasingly rigorously in the course of the century, these rules he often pushed against and resisted, and we can see this resistance set out in the discours, and you can explore these if you have a look at Barnwell's writings on the theatre listed in works cited on your handout. Mary Jo Maratore then takes up this point and thinks about Corneille's position as a dramatist and whether these tensions that he clearly perceives and his resistance to rules that are increasingly being set down might also be somehow being professed or alluded to in this play. She notes, for instance, that Richelieu and the Academy pronounce on artistic, aesthetic qualities to do with theatre, and are able to do this because they've inherited positions of power. They're part of the establishment. And she queries whether it's clear or not that they've earned the right to do so. We see that on page 58. And what Muratori stresses is Corneille's pride in his play, and the pride, and that the fact that that pride derives very much from its original and its unconventional structure. He wants to stress, and you'll see this in his writings around the play, that it is a play which adheres to all of the rules, but he also very much wants to celebrate that it's original and that it's unconventional. And in fact, other plays, particularly Le Cid, which generated a huge querelle around it, this play, along with Rantaine, was highly successful in its day, despite its unconventionality. And you can see actually under on the handout under a history play, that third section then, I've just noted down there the quotation from the Examen that really demonstrates Corneille's pride in what he's invented plot-wise. Okay, finally, you'll see some critics taking a psychoanalytical angle with respect to the play. So there are critics that explore the sibling relationship and particularly the twin relationship. There are others that explore the notion of friendship in the play, particularly that between the two brothers, but also the death drive. Perhaps one can associate that death drive particularly with Antiochus and his willingness to make himself a sacrificial victim. Finally, along these lines, we might also note that Rodogune has been orphaned and that's certainly another line that might be explored. Okay, I'll leave it there for now. We'll pick up many of these themes in seminars. And if you go to the general bibliography, you'll find some other works that you may find useful to read around the play before coming to the seminar next week. The seminar worksheet is also available on the webpage and available from the forum. And I'll be looking for somebody to review one of the articles set out on that worksheet. Thanks very much then.